Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect. You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters. You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters. You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Here, and I apologize for any technical difficulties. If you've heard the Deep Waters intro a few times today, my Skype just really went wonky on me just now, and our guest has even had troubles, but we're here now. Hopefully things are happening just fine. My guest today is Holly Ordway, and she's a professor at HBU, and her area is literary apologetics, which is a topic I'm really not too familiar with, which is also a great benefit of doing a show like this. You get a good education every time. So right now we're going to go to Dr. Ordway here. Are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Excellent. So, overcoming technical difficulties. It's all good.
Yeah. Now, my audience might not know much about you right now, so why should they be paying attention to what you have to say today?
Well, you've introduced me as working in literary apologetics, and so perhaps the best way to get started is to say how those two things came together for me. I'm actually working in apologetics. I'm the chair of the Department of Apologetics at Houston Baptist University, where we just started this year, we started a brand new Master of Arts in Apologetics program, with an emphasis in cultural apologetics. And so I'm actually working, this is what I do, running the program, directing the program, and also teaching in the program, teaching people in how to do cultural apologetics, how to be effective apologists. So that's the practical aspect of my work in terms of apologetics. And what I bring to it, particularly from the literary angle, is actually my background is in English literature. My PhD is in English literature. So I'm really a literary scholar who does apologetics, and they meet in our program in cultural apologetics.
Okay. Now, if I remember from when you were on the Unbelievable program, you were an atheist at one time, right?
I was, yes, up until about 7 years ago, actually. I was not a believer.
And it was your reading of literature that really changed things, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually the interesting thing about that is that both classical apologetics and imaginative apologetics had a really important part to play in my conversion, because I was raised in not a hostile environment, but simply a non-religious one. And then I went to very, very good schools, public universities, University of Massachusetts, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where I sort of absorbed the secular and anti-Christian mindset. And without any good reasons to believe otherwise, I ended up becoming more and more firmly atheist. So by the time I was in my late 20s, I was very firmly and vehemently an atheist, because I thought that was what was actually true. Uh-huh. And so eventually I ended up encountering apologetic arguments, the classic arguments, cosmological arguments, C.S. Lewis's argument for morality, the historical arguments for the resurrection, and becoming convinced that Christianity was actually true, that this is how the world actually works. And that's something I wrote about quite a bit in a book I wrote in 2010, a memoir, Not God's Type. Now, since then, the interesting thing has been in my speaking and my writing and my reflection and my work since that time, I found myself coming back again and again to what I realized was the key question. I eventually was convinced by arguments that certain things that Christians claimed were actually true, but what happened to bring me to the table to even take those arguments seriously when I previously had just dismissed them as not worth my time? And that was what led me to tease out the work of the imagination and realize that something I had touched on and written about but not quite realized the importance of was that it was really in the reading of literature, not just right before my conversion, but going all the way back into my childhood, that was actually where God's grace had been operating. It was really, I realized when I thought about it, that I first heard the gospel in Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. That was where I first heard the good news. Didn't realize what it was. And then rereading poetry as an atheist English professor, rereading poetry so I could teach it, caught me, it grabbed me, it intrigued me, it drew me to think there's something more here that I want to investigate, and that's what brought me to the point where I was interested in these arguments and would take them seriously. And that's what led me to think about the imagination as really a critically important part of the apologetic enterprise. Because until people are interested in the questions, the best arguments in the world will just be flat and dead. And unless you have a real meaning invested in the words, unless you know what you mean by words like resurrection, it's meaningless. It's just an intellectual game. And so that's really the pivot. My own experience of conversion is a big part of what motivates my work now.
Now, when you talk about this kind of change coming, it's interesting. Like, you didn't mention being converted through reading books like, say, your colleague, Mike Lacona's The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. I'm sure books like that played some part in your journey, but it was really the imagination that played a major role, wasn't it?
I think so, because in looking back, it was the imagination where I was able to experience a vision of the world, to see what is the world like if Christianity is true, if this vision of the world is true, the world is a certain way. And so, for instance, in reading C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia or Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, two you know, books that were very influential, there's a certain way of seeing the world that's different from, for instance, when I would read atheist fiction and get a different view of the world. And there was something that drew me about the Christian worldview, the Christian way of seeing, I guess I would say. And it attracted me, and it resonated. And now I know why it resonated, because it was referring to something that was true and real. But it just drew me. And once I actually got to the point of saying, okay, this is compelling. This is something that's meaningful. Is it actually really historically true? That's the point where we're so for instance, Mike Lacona's book wasn't one that specifically I read. It actually came out after I became a Christian, if I'm not mistaken, on the date. But for instance, Gary Habermas's book, The Risen Jesus, and N.T. Wright's magisterial volume, The Resurrection of the Son of God, were very important for me, because they established it with just convincingly, with evidence and rational argument, you know, this really happened. The resurrection happened. So what are you going to do about it? And that was essential, because if I had just been drawn to Christianity but not been convinced it was actually true, I wouldn't have become a Christian, because I wouldn't have taken that step, because I wouldn't have felt that there was anything solid to step forward into, so to speak. So it was a really, I think, a combination of the two things that was essential. And they played back and forth, because, for instance, when I was engaging with the arguments for the resurrection, I was reading N.T. Wright's book, and I was convinced at a certain point by his historical argument and his evidences, I was convinced that he was recounting an event that had actually happened, but I felt that there was a missing piece in my own understanding. And intuitively, I realized that it was an understanding of what the incarnation meant. And what I ended up doing, and I think my imagination guided me well, I actually went back and reread some of the volumes of Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. And that was where I was able to put the pieces together and say, this is what it means for God to be incarnate. And then I could go back and say, and look, here's the evidence that it actually happened. And that put everything together. And I think that really both pieces are equally necessary, because without the knowledge that this really happened, how can I base my life on this if it is just something of that I hope is true, or that I wish were true, or that's very appealing? I needed to know this actually is true. But on the other hand, if I had just had these facts but hadn't had a meaning to say I get what the incarnation is at a deep level, then I wouldn't have understood the significance of it. And that's, those two pieces together were pivotal.
Yeah, I can already hear some atheist listeners in here and saying, yeah, imagination, it's all made up and such. Perhaps we should talk about what we mean by imagination, to be clear.
That's a great question. And we have to actually take quite a big step back and think about what do we even mean by imagination in the first place. And the imagination, it really is a mode of knowing. It's a mode of putting pieces together, of being able in your mind to conceptualize something that's not present. But we do that. We necessarily do that all the time whenever we think about other people. I'm on a phone conversation with you, but I am in my mind imagining you on the other side of the line and imagining the listeners. Those listeners, we have at least one, and you are not imaginary, but I am imagining them. And that's a necessary part of what it means to be human. I'm taking data. I hear your voice. There's certain things you've told me about the program. And with that data, my imagination puts it together such that I can actually relate to you, even though I only have your voice and a few pieces of information. And so our imagination is a synthesizing faculty. It's what allows us to draw conclusions. So really the imagination is something that works with reason. Because if I give you a series of facts, say, you know, let's say you're looking at your bank account and, okay, here's a fact about one bill, here's a fact about another bill, here's a fact about your total balance. Well, rationally, you need to be able to do the math to connect those. But then imaginatively, you have to be able to say, oh, no, I am about to be overdrawn. I ought not to order that new book on Amazon. And so the imagination is a synthesizing cognitive faculty that allows you to draw a conclusion from the simple math. And then the will can act on it. I either will restrain myself from clicking buy now, or I will say, ah, who cares about being overdrawn? I'll pay it off later, and I'll click buy now anyway. So in this sense, the imagination is it's a cognitive faculty, and if we didn't have it, we wouldn't be able to use our reason. We would, because, for instance, computers are purely rational. Computers are full of facts. Computers can do processes, but a computer can never go from here are the facts to here's the meaning, and that's what the imagination allows us to do. Now, the reason I think that people dismiss the imagination goes actually back to the Enlightenment. I'm as a literary scholar, I'm partly an Inkling scholar, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, but I'm also partly a medievalist. And so I'm very interested in what happened between the medieval period and the modern period, because the mindset's quite different. And in the Enlightenment, what you end up having is a split between the imagination and the reason, between facts and values is another, you know, aspect of what happened. And we end up having this idea that somehow things we can count, measure, touch, taste are real, quote unquote, in a way that things we can't touch, taste, measure are not. And the imagination kind of gets short-tripped. Exactly. And the thing is values get dumped in that. But also a lot of other things. Like if I can count, the dollars in my bank account, but I can't measure the conclusions I draw from it. Oh no, I had better manage my budget better. Yet that's a real thing that happened. And the Enlightenment split doesn't account for how we can do that. So I think one of the problems with talking about the imagination is that we have divorced it so much from reality, and we've kind of bought into it. We think, oh, entertainment, imagination is just play. Well, it can be just divorced from reality and cut off, but that's not how it ought to be. The imagination is actually part of how we relate to the world. So storytelling and literature is an imaginative expression. But I think the important thing to know is that the imagination as a human faculty is fundamental to what it means to be human. And that imagination is innately involved in everything from doing science to interacting with other people to creating literature, which is what I'm concerned with.
Well, we're going to take our first break now. We'll be back in a little bit with Dr. Holly Ordway talking about literary projects, already being a fascinating show. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store. Or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And I'm Nick Peters. We are back with Dr. Holly Ordway from Houston Baptist University. We are talking about literary apologetics today. And, you know, when I've been thinking about what you're saying and such coming on here and writing a blog in advance, I know it's that usually I very, very rarely take time to read anything that's a work of fiction, except for, as I told you just a while ago in show prep, I read mysteries sometimes. And I was thinking, that's really a downside. And I think it's a great temptation most of us in your projects you're going to have to think. We're so busy with our academic work, we need to be focused on the serious, important subjects, and we don't have time to read fiction. And you'd say that's a mistake, wouldn't you?
I would. But first, I would actually say that it cuts both ways, because I think someone who only reads fiction, I would tell that person, no, you should also read nonfiction. You should also engage with other forms of writing. So I do think it cuts both ways. But I think talking to apologists, we do need to read imaginative literature, and that would be fiction, poetry, drama. And I think there's several things I could tease out about why I think that's important. Because I think reading imaginative literature really gives us something that reading propositional, rational, factual information doesn't. For one, it gives us an engagement with the world that's different. It allows us to experience the world in different ways. Because you could, for instance, read a book about Anglo-Saxon England and learn about the history, what happened. It could be a very well-written book, very informative. But then to read the Old English poem Beowulf, you would get a sense of what the world was like for people in the year 700 AD. What is it like to have this heroic ethos and make a connection between the way that people then saw the world, responded to it, the way that we see the world, we respond to it. I think that it's very possible, very easy to fall into what Owen Barfield called chronological snobbery, where we think that our time period is the best, the most well-informed, up-to-date. We tend to use that as a positive phrase when it's actually almost meaningless. It just means now. But if we are able to read other time periods, we're able to see the world that we live in and see the problems that we have to face through different eyes, and it allows us a different perspective on our own time. And because when we read, for instance, nonfiction, generally speaking, we're reading it written by people from our own time period. So they have our same perspective. But if we read Jane Austen, we're seeing culture from, Regency England, 1815, and she's seeing the world a little bit differently than we are. And she's forcing us or helping us to step out and see the relationships between men and women a little bit differently and say, oh, now I can understand something about the way men and women interact through the difference, through the slight difference in culture and time, that now I can step back into my own time period and say, ah, these are some elements that are timeless, that are human nature, and these are some elements that are simply our culture influencing things. And so that difference in perspective is something I think that literature can give us almost better than anything else.
We had Tim McGrew on here a few months or so ago, and he's one who always stresses, read old books. Read old books, because there's so much good in them that today we have people that are kind of reinventing the wheel.
Yes. And really, I think reading old books, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, but I think reading literature, old literature, you actually get the kind of the best of both worlds, because you get works that have been sort of past the test of time. So when you're reading those, in addition to getting a sense of a different world and a different culture, I think it also helps us to engage with language and its meaning more. And that's something that interests me very much as an apologist and really as a writer, which is the way that we use words and the way that those words shift their meaning and what those words mean for our culture. And I think it's very easy to forget that words shift in their meaning and they shift in the way that they're understood. But if we read broadly and we're able to see the meaning that you know, an author from 1500, an author from 1800, an author from 1900, how those authors use words and use language, I think it actually opens up greater possibilities for us to understand the way we're using language now, how we're using it, what words mean, how culture has changed, how it continues to change, and how words mm-hmm. have changed in their meaning.
You know, it's been said by some people that whoever controls the language controls everything else. If you can control what words mean, you can win any debate. In a couple of weeks, we're going to have some people on here who came out of a homosexual movement. And I remember a while back knowing someone that I don't like to use the term gay. I just prefer using the term homosexual. And, well, you know, we just use that the term gay so much. And when do you ever hear it being used the other way? And someone jumped in immediately and said, every year at Christmas time when you sing Deck the Halls. But if you change the meaning of one word to give it a more positive connotation, and isn't it something also that George Orwell warned us about in The Politics of Language?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the prime example, I think, really is in abortion issues, where
but.
Using language that using certain terms that are more scientifically associated with science, and here it's interesting
right.
to know the etymology of words, because Latin-based and Greek-based terms, because they were brought in the 1700s specifically for this expansion of this Enlightenment expansion interest in technology, they actually have a sort of implicit power to them, and there's a sort of assumed neutrality to a scientific-sounding word that leads people to think it's neutral. And so if you have, for instance, the phrase termination of pregnancy, that sounds neutral and objective, but in fact, you're conceding ground. You're actually saying, and you use that phrase, you are already accepting that the unborn child is not a person, because you're not talking
right.
about killing a person, killing every small person.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting the way that people in this particular debate, the pro-choice advocates will accuse pro-life advocates of being emotional. But that, again, is manipulative, because among other things, why shouldn't you be emotional about murder? I think that's
right.
a legitimate thing to be emotional about.
Again,
right. attempting to presuppose the conclusion. Oh, it's emotional language to say that abortion is the murder of a child. Well, kill a child is good Anglo-Saxon English, you know, in Anglo-Saxon rooted words for what's happening. Termination of pregnancy is Latinate scientific language that presupposes the conclusion. And what we want to say is, okay, if you use the Anglo-Saxon rooted words, kill a child, you should make the argument why that should be legal. Make the argument
right.
why it should be legal to kill a child. And if they'll say, well, actually now abortion advocates are actually making that argument, which is at least getting things out where we're talking about the same thing. But language does matter. It matters a great deal.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just realized that I forgot to tell everyone the call-in number. If you want to call and ask a question about literary apologetics, the number is 714-242-5180. And something else I was thinking about when you were talking about how you can read about an ancient period, but you can then read a fictional novel or some other work like that set in that period, and it changes things. And I think one other way you could say it changes things, and if I'm wrong, you can correct me, is that when you read a novel or maybe even a work of historical fiction, you have a main character and you start thinking along with the main character and seeing with their eyes, and so that changes the way you think when you come back to the modern times.
Exactly. And actually, I think that's a good point to bring up about reading literature in general, because I think
mm-hmm.
one of the problems, and I think apologists and academics in general, not just apologists,
mm-hmm.
tend to
mm-hmm.
be vulnerable to this sort of, well, frankly, it's a kind of Gnosticism, the sense that we are primarily our intellects, and we
mm-hmm.
have this disembodied intellectual approach to learning about history and learning facts about the era. But we forget that's, you know, that was a time and place with human beings, and we care about it because of the human beings. Literature, as you correctly noted, takes us into the experience, and it reminds us that all history matters because it's the story of human beings interacting with each other.
And we also know that there's also a difference between this and, say, watching the movie on the big screen or on TV, because when you watch it there, someone is already doing the imagining for you. You don't get to imagine what taking over the castle or fighting the dragon is like. Someone else is doing that for you.
Yeah, and it's interesting because film, I think there's, it's important to recognize film is a very legitimate art form in its own. But I think it needs to be classified with the visual arts, and it gets, I think, classified with sort of like as if it were a filmed version of literature, and it's not. It uses visual things, for lack of a better word. Yes, you can tell I'm not a specialist in film. But that's actually one of the reasons we have a course actually on film in our apologetics program, film and the visual arts, because it's a mode of engaging, it's a mode of telling a story. But you're right, it doesn't require the viewer to actively imagine in the way that reading literature does. It's a visual and auditory immersion that you have to respond to differently, and most of the reflection has to happen after the fact, after you've had this experience. So it's quite a different mode, I think.
Yeah, and one of the benefits, I think, also of reading other works, and this includes nonfiction works in this case, is that it's no longer you alone thinking your own thoughts. You now have the thoughts of several other people, you know, because in our own thinking, we're often very, very mistaken. But if I have the thoughts of Chesterton, Plato, Lewis, etc. in my head as well, that makes things different.
Yeah, you put yourself into a conversation, basically. That's actually one of the things, too, why I think there's a bit of a renewal in the interest in great books. It's one of the things exciting about HBU is that our undergraduate core is a great books focused core. And I think there's more great books focused programs coming up. And I think it's important to have a sustained engagement with the great authors, in part because they're great for themselves, but also because of their contribution to the ongoing conversation. By spending time with these great authors, then you get what the conversation is in a way that you don't if you just dip in here and there.
Mm-hmm. You know, since this is a Christian show, we should definitely talk about the Bible in this regard, because usually we want to treat it as holy writ, which it certainly is. But at the same time, we do overlook that the Bible is still, while it's divine, it's still a work of literature, and it should be treated like a work of literature. What does literary apologetics have to say about Scripture in this regard?
Well, I think, in a sense, Scripture gives us the first and most powerful example of literary apologetics, because Jesus uses parables to teach.
Yeah.
And that is storytelling, and the stories themselves, if you go back and you read them thinking about them simply as stories, they're really good stories. Like the parable of the prodigal son is a good story. And that's key, because it isn't just a case of using a couple of cardboard characters and, you know, okay, here's your moral. No, Jesus is a good storyteller. He's captivating just for the stories themselves. And they also have another layer because he's using them to teach. So even in that, we have an example of the fact that literature can convey meaning. Because, for instance, with the parable of the prodigal son, our Lord could have said, God loves you and will forgive you if you repent and come back to him. And that pretty much sums up at least the baseline of the parable of the prodigal son. Well, the fact is he didn't do that. He chose to tell the story instead. because the story gives you imaginative engagement, it allows you to enter into the story of the younger son, what he was thinking, his process of the downward spiral. It gives you characters to engage with. It gives you an exciting moment where your father comes running out. You have the elder brother, who's this figure that you have to think, am I the elder brother in the story? There's so much more that's going on there. It's not reducible to a statement that God loves you and will forgive you if you repent and turn to him. Now, that's a true statement, but the parable that Jesus gives us is that and more. And that's what literature, that's really what literature can do. One of the things that literature can do, and that touches on something that I think is very important for apologists today who want to use literature to present the Christian message. You can't just say, here is message X, and I'm going to wrap a story around it. No, that's going to get you bad fiction, and no one's going to be interested. What you need to do is to be a good storyteller so that the story itself is powerful in itself. And then anything, the deeper meaning that you have in it will come out. And again, I think that's modeled for us in the way that Jesus handles his parables. But even, I think the question of literature in the Bible, it's critical because Scripture is, you know, it's inspired by God, it's authoritative, it's true, but it's also poetry. It's also narrative. I mean, there's so much of the Bible's poetry. The purely theological parts are by far the minority. And all the ups and downs of the Israelites, that could have been summarized in, okay, the Israelites have the following characteristics, don't be like that. But no, we get a story, we get a narrative, we get stories of people doing very terrible things. We get stories of dysfunctional families, you know, Jacob and Esau and all of that. Because we are creatures, we are people who learn and understand through narrative, through story, through character. And I think that if we approach the Bible as an instruction manual for how to live a Christian life, that's entirely the wrong approach. That's not what Scripture itself is doing. And we have to appreciate, okay, we have apocalyptic literature, which has certain types of imagery. We have psalms. We have lots of poetic imagery. We have metaphor. We have symbol. We've got some allegory going on. We've got straight-up narrative. We've got various techniques that the authors use to bring out the meaning that's not, strictly speaking, literal, quote-unquote. And I think if you approach it that way, it doesn't undermine the truth of Scripture. It correctly points out that Scripture presents truth in a variety of modes that we can connect to in a variety of ways. You can't read the Psalms like you read Paul's letters. They're just different.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, this brings to mind a whole new question, but I think it's going to be a very complicated one. And since that's the case, we're going to go on ahead and take our second break a little bit early. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Holly Ordway talking about literary apologetics. We will be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I'm Nick Peters. We're back to the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. Holly Ordway. We're talking about literary apologetics. If you want to call in and ask a question, the number is 714-242-5180. And you were talking about all the different styles of writing in the Bible. And I'm thinking usually we have difficulties with Christians and atheists both who seem to have this idea that everything in the text is to be taken literally. For instance, I remember someone recently posting something about a statement in Revelation and saying, this is scientific nonsense. And I'm looking, And Revelation is also apocalyptic literature. Do you not understand that? Is this really a dangerous way for us to think, even as Christians, that we should always be going to a text and saying, let's take it literally?
Absolutely. I could not agree with you more. And in fact, I want to step back and give the technical literary definition of the word literal, because it doesn't mean what people think it means. Literal, to read the text literally, the word literal means as the author intended. So what the author wrote, so for example, if you look at the Psalms and you have a Psalm, for instance, a line that says, the Lord is my rock. Well, the words that the psalmist wrote are, the Lord is my rock. Now, in the shallow, mistaken sense of literal is, the psalmist wrote that God is a large piece of stone. Well, that's not actually a correct, that is a false reading. That is not what the psalmist literally meant. What the psalmist was doing, the literal meaning of that line is that it is a metaphor. It is saying that when God is X, that is a literary device. It's a metaphor, and the intention is that the reader or hearer will recognize that it's a metaphor and realize that what the psalmist is literally doing is saying God has certain characteristics such as solidity and trustworthiness that are best expressed with the visual image of a large piece of stone, because stones don't move. And God is my rock is just a much better way of expressing that poetically than what I just said. So I think the problem is that, frankly, Christians don't know how to read literature. And so I think there's a real sense of missing the literary cues, where what the author actually intended to do was to use metaphors, symbols, and allusions and allegories to convey something specific and something true. But if we focus on a sense of reading the words just as they are, it's like looking at a picture too long and it sort of degenerates into dots because we don't see the picture anymore. And I think that the first question we have to ask in a literary text is, okay, what's the genre? What expectations do I bring to this text to understand what the author's saying?
Yeah, I usually find this, as atheists, when we're talking about that the Gospels, for instance, contain historical information about people, places, and such, and I say, where so do Spider-Man comics and Harry Potter novels, which I'm thinking, and the Gospels are Greco-Roman biographies, unlike Harry Potter and Spider-Man comics.
Yeah, and we have to understand, we have to come to it with the expectation of the genre that it is. And these things, I mean, every genre has certain signals that if you read widely enough, you'll actually realize that reading, and this is an experience I had as an atheist reading the Gospels, I have an extensive background, an academic background in fantasy literature, folklore, and mythology.
Right.
This is part of what I did my academic work on. I wrote my dissertation on fantasy novels. So when I came to read the Gospels, I read them, and I recognized as an academic, as an English professor and a literary critic, these works are not fictional in their intent. These works are historical. Now, that doesn't mean they get their facts right, but it means that the author's intent, as signaled by a variety of literary signals, it simply does not have the characteristics of myth or a folktale or a fantasy. And these things are kind of gestalt. They're groups of characteristics. But if you've been reading widely enough and extensively enough in the genres, you'll recognize it. So if you read the Gospels, if you read them knowledgeably, you will say, yes, these are Greco-Roman-style biographies. They're historical narratives. And then that's not presupposing that they're accurate, mind you. It's just saying this is their genre. Now we can look at what information is in these. And one of the things I think that's important to note and I think Christians need to realize this, is that the genre, the Greco-Roman approach to writing biography and history, has some different understandings than we do about structuring. We, in the present modern day, we're obsessed with chronology. Like, we have to tell things in a certain order, or somehow it's wrong or not true. But in these biographies that we have, the Gospels, you know, for instance, John or any of the evangelists, they're choosing the order and the sequencing of their events to heighten what they're trying to say. They're being selective. They're sometimes compressing. They're moving things around. So a lot of what is allegedly contradictions in the Gospels is simply the author choosing to structure that particular Gospel so as most effectively to showcase the true events and their significance. And I'm particularly keenly aware of this now because I wrote a memoir, and over the summer I revised my memoir. It's coming out in a revised and expanded edition next year from Ignatius. And it occurred to me that as a writer of, I'm writing a memoir of my own conversion, and I'm using a lot of the techniques that people don't notice in the Gospels, things like compression. There's a lot that I leave out, compression of time span, selectivity in my sources. I couldn't tell everything. It would detract from the point that I'm trying to make. I leave out certain things. I actually do a certain amount of interleaving of events in the chronology. I do flashbacks and flash forwards because as an author, I'm telling my true story. It's factually true. But I also want my readers to know the meaning of the events. And so I use literary devices to make that clearer. And anybody who reads any biography of any written by a modern person, if you read it, you'll see the same thing. This is what biographers do. This is what autobiographers, like both biographers and writers of autobiography is in my case. And we intuitively get that, oh yeah, it's important to tell a good story so that it sticks with you, so that we get what this is really about. It's not just a collection of facts. Mm-hmm. And then if we go back and look at the Gospels, why would we think that the evangelist who wanted their readers not just to know, here are some things that this guy Jesus did, but they wanted them to see, this is why these events were important. Well, of course they're going to use literary devices to present that effectively. If they didn't, I'd be shocked.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. I'd like to go back to something you said a little bit earlier when I asked you a question. You said, and I went on, as an English literary critic and scholar, when I went back and read the Gospels, I could tell these were not historical fiction, that these were not written to teach fiction. They were written with the intent of a history, and I know this because I've read a lot of fantasy literature. And I was listening, and I was thinking, has Harvey Ordway been possessed by the spirit of C.S. Lewis suddenly? But he said pretty much the exact same thing, didn't he?
He did. He did. And actually, I read that after. I read, this was in, I think it's Surprised by Joy that he says this. I read it after I became a Christian, and I thought, yeah, there you go. Because it's he had very much the same background as me. I think that's one of the reasons I found him such a useful scholar, useful academic to draw on, other than the fact that he's brilliant. But he had the same experience, because if you really do know the genres, you will simply recognize what the Gospels are. And I think that it would be helpful. Well, people just need to read more. Really.
Yeah.
Would be what I would fundamentally say.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about works of fiction and such as well. And one thing I said in my blog post is fiction has been with us, I'd say, from the beginning. But let's move on from the on of church history. Now, one work you mentioned earlier was Beowulf. Now, I remember reading that when I was in high school. We had to read. We might not have read the whole thing, but we had some assigned readings. And Beowulf was a Christian classic, wasn't it?
So I didn't catch the last thing that you said.
Beowulf was a Christian book, wasn't it?
Well, actually, the interesting thing is that there's a little bit of debate about that. I think that the general consensus is that the person who actually wrote down the text of Beowulf was a Christian. This is certain. This is pretty much uncontested. The question is to what extent the material that he's using, did he invent it? Is it an original composition? To what extent did he use previous epics and stories, pagan ones? And it's an interesting question for me as a literary scholar, but I'll just actually kind of step back and give what I think the significance of it for the modern reader. Beowulf is a great poem. It's one of the most important poems, I think, in English literature. It's fantastic. By the way, Seamus Heaney has a really good translation. He was a poet laureate who died very recently. It's a great translation. But Beowulf is a poem that is, on the surface, it's very similar to any of the sort of Norse or Germanic epics. It's a hero who comes, he slays the monster Grendel, he slays Grendel's mother, and eventually he kills a dragon. So there's, in that sense, it's very sort of typical epic. And the interesting thing also, and this is where people will start to question, is this a Christian work or not? The name of Christ is never mentioned in the poem. It's not explicitly Christian at all. You get an Old Testament kind of glimpse. But what I think is important for literary apologetics in sort of looking at what's going on here, if you look at the worldview that's being expressed in this poem, it's actually a fascinating, deeply Christian ethos that's basically baptizing the old pagan warrior ethos. And if you look at it that way, then you realize, okay, this really is fundamentally a Christian poem, because the Christian monk is either retelling or writing a story based on these older elements, in which his understanding of virtue, what does it mean to be virtuous, is informing the way that he presents his hero, the way that he presents the whole situation. And that, I think, is part of what makes it so fantastic, because the poet didn't sit down, as far as I can tell, and say, I wish to teach my audience about what it means to be a Christian. I think I'll sort of bring in a warrior to do that. Well, no. I think he's telling a really just knock your socks off great story, but he's so deeply Christian himself that his vision of what it means to be a man of honor, Beowulf comes to serve. He hears that Harrowhall is being besieged by this monster Grendel, and he arrives in order to help and puts his own life at risk. And so we have really a model of servanthood. He is a warrior, and he's using his gift, his physical strength, to help serve others and protect those who need help. And we have a really neat exploration of pride and how in the end, actually, he ends up becoming prideful and suffers for it. But what I think a work like Beowulf can show us, Beowulf is written, Anglo-Saxon England, that particular context, deeply Christian, and it's medieval, it's Anglo-Saxon. So it's prior to this Enlightenment split that I talked about, where there's some sense that meaning is separate from facts, and values are separate from facts, and imagination is separate from reason. None of that has happened yet. We have a kind of holistic, integrated view of the world. And I think that sense of integration is really vibrantly present in a work like Beowulf. And I think as writers and as critics, we have a lot to learn from that kind of integrated worldview.
And it seems that a lot of people might shy away from something like that also, because it's such, there's so much war and violence and such in it, but that would also be a mistake, wouldn't it?
It would, because I think, and this is a very, very interesting question, and I think it harkens back to St. Paul's injunction to think about what's true, what's good, what's beautiful, what's lovely, what's excellent, think on these things. And these are words in Scripture. We need to take this very seriously. This is a authoritative injunction that we should do this. But what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Think on things that are true. Think on things that are beautiful. Dwell on these things. Well, Paul, I think, is not saying that true and beautiful and excellent are necessarily all synonyms. I think that as Christians, we have to look at our fallen world and recognize this is what it is. We live in a world, I mean, today, the world is torn with war. As we write this, you know, people are dying in Syria, as we have the podcast. And this is the reality of the world that we live in. This is true. So on the one hand, to pretend otherwise, to say we're not going to think, we're not going to acknowledge in our art any sense of violence is actually falsehood. It's falsely representing the world we live in, and it does a great deal of harm because it gives people no voice and no way to cope with or deal with pain and difficulty. It's like whitewashing it, and this is tremendously harmful. And I think it harms a lot of people. They turn away from the faith, I think, sometimes, because there's no way for them to express pain or fear or sorrow or anger when in a redemptive way. Now, what I think the injunction here would help us to do is say, okay, we need to tell the truth about the world, and that involves recognizing brokenness and recognizing war. But we don't have to do it in an exploitative way, and in fact, we shouldn't. And one of the things that's interesting in a disturbing way, modern secular culture has become extremely exploitative, and I'm horrified by horror films because they have become extraordinarily gratuitous. And even just in the last 10 years, we've gone from things that were simply scary. You know, if you think back to the classic, you know, 1960s Alfred Hitchcock film Psycho, it's terrifying that you don't see the, you know, the blood and the guts. But now you see these horror movies when it's the ante keeps getting upped for how much blood and dismemberment and violence is actually shown on screen. I think that's a very wrong thing to do, because I think that actually desensitizes us and makes us less able to recognize genuine suffering. So I think as Christians, we have to look at how do we balance that. Now, if you look, for instance, at Beowulf, take that poem as an example, you have Grendel, the monster, who is really in some ways representative of evil. I think for the original authors, for the original audience, Grendel, he's a monster. He's not allegorical. It's genuinely in the story a monster. But I think for the original audiences, that monster figure would have conjured up for them associations with the Viking raiders, who were the terrorists of the 8th century. So we can say, okay, here's this figure of evil, this figure of monstrous attack and harm and violence, and here comes Beowulf, and he needs to fight this monster. And that is depicted in a way, and there's, you know, it's a bit gruesome. He rips Grendel's arm off, but it doesn't dwell on that. It allows that violence to be shown because, yes, this is part of the situation. This violence has to be met somehow. Beowulf meets it, and we need to be able to appreciate the danger and the threat of it. So we get enough detail. But you don't have page after page of the poet dwelling on it, which is what you get equivalent in a lot of modern literature. So I think there's that balance between you need to acknowledge it, but you don't want to be voyeuristic or exploitative. And there's a middle ground. And it's sometimes difficult to keep that middle ground. But just because it's difficult doesn't mean we should abandon it and just not try.
Well, we're going to take our third commercial break, and something that you said leads me to the next topic I think we're going to discuss, and we'll be back to discuss that after this break. I'm Nick Peters. This is Deeper Waters Podcast with Dr. Holly Ordway discussing literary apologetics. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back with Holly Ordway. Here's our guest discussing literary apologetics. The call in number is 714-242-5180. Now, you start talking about horror just now, and I think a lot of Christians out there listening would be saying, we should have nothing to do with horror because that's meant to scare us, and fear is not of God. But as you and I had talked about earlier, Bram Stoker's Dracula, certainly a work of horror, is actually a Christian classic. So how is it that Christians can write about horror like this?
Well, first, this is a great topic. And first I would step back and say, okay, fear is not of God. Okay, kind of. In one sense, that's true.
Yeah.
But then if you think about the fact that whenever angels show up in Scripture, the first thing they always say is, fear not. And if you think about it, why do they have to say that? Because they just scared the pants off of whoever they're appearing to. Angels, apparently, are such figures of power that they're terrifying. And this is a normal human response to something out of our ken. Fear, actually, is a perfectly rational, reasonable, natural human response to things that are totally unexpected and kind of throw us out of our depth. And so the fact that the angels have to say, don't be afraid, is really a validation of the human response of fear. So then turning to horror, in a certain extent, the capacity to be afraid is the capacity to recognize certain forms of transcendence, that there are things bigger than we are, that there are things that are overwhelming in our power. And I think that's my colleague at HBU, Garrett Johnson, has been writing a very interesting series of posts at my blog, Chiropraxis, on weird fiction and horror fiction and the sort of the theology of fear. And he's made a very interesting case that even an atheist writer like H.P. Lovecraft, who writes these cosmic horror stories, Lovecraft is actually got some common ground with Christians because he's recognizing that there's something bigger than us. There's a sense of transcendence, and it frightens him. And I think it's a healthy reminder for Christians. And I remember this when I was first, you know, thinking about, wow, God actually might be real. I was scared because it was so much bigger. It was terrifying. And I think Christians can get a little bit too comfortable with a cozy, buddy Jesus view of God.
Yeah.
And they don't realize this is the cosmic Christ. This is Christ is the Word through whom all things were made. And yes, he is also the Word made flesh who dwelt among us. It's a both and. But I think if we focus too much on the comforting aspects, it puts God in a very small, kind of cute, cozy box that he doesn't fit in. And a healthy dose of terror, I think, can be a healthy wake-up call to say, well, you know what? To come before the face of the living God is a frankly terrifying experience. John in the Apocalypse, in the Revelation of John, he falls on his face. This is not a cozy experience. He has to be kind of reassured, you know, get up,
yes.
It's okay. So in that sense,
like
I think theologically,
it's kind of like C.S. Lewis says, he's not safe, but he's good.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I had this conversation with my colleague, Dr. Michael Ward, about that very passage. And it's interesting that many Christians seem almost to reverse that passage, and they seem to think he's not safe, but he's good. And somehow they think of him as the cozy, cuddly lion. But actually what Lewis is trying to say is, have you ever thought about coming before an actual lion? You should be terrified. He could you know, bite your head off. He's not safe. But he's not safe. He's extremely dangerous, but he's good. And it's that tension that we're supposed to keep between unsafe, between dangerous and good. So I think anything that can unsettle us a little bit out of that comfortable treating God, treating, you know, Jesus like a plush toy is good. But I liked what you said about bringing up Dracula, because I think Dracula is a very interesting book to look at, especially in light of the modern trend for vampire literature, things like Stephanie Meyer's Twilight, all of those teen, it's a new genre, paranormal romance. We have all these vampires and werewolves and whatnot, you know, having these romance novels with vampires, etc. And I find it very interesting because if you go back and you look at Bram Stoker's Dracula, it does have a fundamentally Christian ethos to it, because Dracula is evil. He's depicted as evil in the novel, and eventually, I mean, the whole point is that he is hunted down and he is destroyed. And and what I think is most significant is that Stoker does a really good job of conveying the way that evil actually can be seductive. Because if evil simply were blatantly, obviously evil, no one, I hope, would fall for it. But the whole point is that the enemy disguises himself. He attempts to fool us into thinking that what is really evil is attractive in some way. Sin wouldn't be tempting if it didn't appear to be pleasing. And now it's always shallow, it's always hollow and false, but the first appearance is always attractive. And so in Bram Stoker's Dracula, you get a very good depiction of the sexual appeal of Dracula. There's this weird, attractive sexuality that draws people to him, yet also faintly repels at the same time. And as a reader, we're somewhat attracted, we're somewhat drawn, but then the genius of it is that eventually we realize the corruption behind the apparent appeal, and we recognize evil as evil. And that's powerfully Christian in recognizing and I think this is actually a mature way of looking at sin. I think too many Christian writers try to present sin as just completely ugly, completely hateful, for fear that anybody would think it was attractive. But what you end up with is fiction that's false, because it falsifies our actual experience. If sin were never attractive, it would be a whole lot easier to resist it. We have to do both and. We have to show people are drawn in, and also show that it is ultimately false and hollow. Now, what I think is very interesting is the way that the modern paranormal romance genre has picked up on the attractiveness of the vampire figure, but completely dropped the Christian understanding that this attractiveness is deadly.
Yeah, I know my own wife can't stand the Twilight series because she really likes reading about vampires, and like, these are not real vampires. They stalk her.
I know. Don't even get me started on that series. It's just...
Have you started it?
Oh, I know. Well, I've read the whole series because I felt like if I was going to talk about it, I should know it. But yes, I did start it. I did bring up the topic. But I think that is a fundamental shift in our cultural understanding of evil, that we have dropped, we have lost a sense that sin is actually ultimately unsatisfying and harmful and disappointing. Mm-hmm. Sin will always let you down. And I find that links in, like we see, and this actually really bothers me, that people will casually refer to perfectly innocuous things as sinful pleasures. Like, oh, chocolate's my sinful pleasure. No, that's a misuse of language. Now, it would be a sinful pleasure if you spent more money than you could afford on it, or if you were addicted to it and you couldn't give it up, even if you tried, you obsessed over it and you thought of nothing but chocolate. Okay. Yep. Then it would become a sin. But enjoying chocolate is not a sin. It's one of God's good gifts. And I give thanks to him for it. So I find and use of something like that, it is actually, it empties the meaning out of the word sin. And if you accumulate that kind of emptying of meaning, sin no longer means what it ought to mean. And that's why I think as Christian apologists, one of our tasks is to re-infuse meaning into these words. And actually, I think a good example of this is Francis Spufford's book, Unapologetic, came out in the UK last year. I don't know if it's available in the US just yet. I alternated between really agreeing with him and wanting to throw the book across the room. So I'm not saying that this is entirely a book that I agree with. But he's a Christian who is theologically more liberal than I am by a huge margin. But he's a Christian. And he is attempting to give a case for why it's reasonable to be Christian, why it's reasonable to believe. And he's focusing on the emotional case. It's a very interesting apologetic argument. And he's got some very, very good, important things to say, even if I don't agree with some of the places he arrives at, which I don't. Yeah. But I think the most brilliant part of his book is early on when he actually makes a very effective defense or a rehabilitation of the meaning of original sin. Because original sin to most people now is just an old-fashioned term for some crazy thing that Christians believe about, something some guy did that somehow we're to blame for, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And what Francis Spufford does is he says, I want to talk about the human propensity to F things up. and he uses that phrase, only he actually spells it out. And he goes on to talk about it, and he gives examples of the way that human beings always F things up. We always manage to make relationships go wrong. We manage to just make a mess of culture, of civilization. Everything we do, there's an element that something always goes wrong, and it's because of human nature. And by the end, he's actually done a remarkable job of really convincing the reader that there is such a thing as a deep-seated, permanent flaw in human beings that always leads them to hurt other people. And then he goes on to build argument from that. But what he's just done is he's brought meaning back into the term original sin. And it's marvelously effective, and I think we need more of that sort of thing.
Yeah, a few things. First off, I'm sure my wife and I send her sympathies to you, having read the entire Twilight series. And if someone wanted to read Bram Stoker's Dracula, they can read it for free on the Amazon Kindle, actually. And you can also read the book Unapologetic there. But going back to Dracula, to tie in with sin, Dracula is supposed to be a picture, in fact, of the seven deadly sins, isn't he?
I think I would resist that reading of Dracula. I think that's probably not an authorial intention that seems plausible to me. I think that's an example. I think that's an example of a forced allegorizing. That I'm not convinced is something that Stoker was bringing to the text. However, I do think we can legitimately read the text and see examples of perhaps all seven. We might even see all seven in Dracula. I would just be hesitant to say that he's intended in some way to represent that.
But Dracula, in the book, he is overcome, and it's usually done by church rituals and such. Van Helsing, for instance, performs the Eucharist in the book, doesn't he?
It's been a while since I read it, so I don't remember. But I do I do remember that, I mean, one of the key points is that he is overcome. So it is a hope. It is a hopeful message. Now, there's been, and I think this is a deeply Christian message, people suffer in this book. But in the end, evil, by the actions of people who decided to do something about it, Dracula is overcome.
Yeah, and isn't the suffering coming from people who do find Dracula way too appealing, and that's how other people end up becoming vampires, because when Dracula bites someone, that person ends up becoming a vampire.
Yeah, and in a way, this is I think one of the reasons why I think Dracula is such a powerful novel. I think Stoker is not that great as a novelist. I think he's a mid-range novelist. I don't think he's one of the greats, but I think that he's managed to tap into certain images that are more powerful than maybe he realized. Because this image of someone who is bitten by the vampire then becoming the vampire, I think that really speaks to the effects of sin. Sin harms other people, and eventually if you are, you know, drawn into, if you are sinning, it changes you. You become, you are affected by it. And the more you are affected by it, the more difficult it is to back out of it. Now, God's grace can operate on anyone. There is no one who is too far gone in this life to receive God's redeeming grace. But I do think that our ability to respond and the degree of pain that it causes to be transformed certainly increases the more deeply that we're sunk in sin. And even just the idea of being caught up in our modern world offers so many distractions. You know, consumerism, entertainment. You know, we don't need to be bitten by a vampire to become undead. Frankly, our smartphones are all little vampires that draw us, that make us into the walking dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also been the principle that I've heard myth that we tend to become like that which we love the most. And so, I mean, if someone loves sex the most, for instance, where they end up becoming an addict who just uses other people for sex. If they love treasure the most, they become a hedonist. But if they love God the most, they actually become more like God.
Yeah, and I think that is a very important part, I think, also, of something that literature can do for us, because it gives us access to being able to get glimpses of other better things to love. Because if you're stuck in a consumeristic, highly individualistic, narcissistic, self-focused, it's all about what you can buy and about how much sex you can have, how do you see a better thing to love? How do you do that? Mm-hmm. But if you can read, you can all of a sudden step into another worldview, step into another vision of the world, and see through the author's eyes, wait a second, there's something else. There's something different that I could love. And I think that is one of the reasons why literature is so important for apologetics, and why, and this kind of goes back to something I try to stress very often, we have to encourage Christian writers to simply be the very best writers that they can be the best novelists, the best poets, the best artists, and not try to force them. No, you have to have a Christian message. You have to be explicit about your Christian theme. You have to be always thinking about how you're presenting the gospel. No. I think we need to have really well-discipled, well-formed, well-catechized Christians who are producing this art, which will then express a vision of the world powerfully. And then other people will read it, not because they're interested in Christianity, but because they want something good to read, and they'll be captivated by it, and they'll be drawn into it, and they'll get a glimpse through the beauty and the power of that book. And I think that's so important, and we can't do that. We can't offer that lifeline to people if our fiction gets ghettoized in the Christian fiction section.
We're going to take our next break here, and we'll come back. We're going to talk about the Inklings. Nick Pierce, my guest is Dr. Holly Ordway. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyi.org. grockworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'm Nick Peters. Our guest is Dr. Holly Ordway. If you want to call in, the number is 714-242-5180. We're talking about literary apologetics. And I would like to remind people, based on what we just played, that this is a donor-supported show. Everything I do pretty much is donation-supported. And if you'd like to support Deeper Waters, you can go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com, click the donate button, and you can help me out that way. Or you can go make a donation to us through tectonics.org or through Risen Jesus. And through Ratio Christi, I'm the social media and communications expert for Ratio Christi. And speaking of Ratio Christi, our guest next week is John Stewart of Ratio Christi. He is their new international director, getting ready to launch that. And he's going to be coming on and talking about what Ratio Christi is doing. So I hope you'll be here next week. Now, Dr. Ordway, I said before last break that we were going to be talking about the Inklings. Now, I think a lot of people might know who the Inklings are, but they might not really be familiar with the term. So who are the Inklings?
The Inklings is a term for a group of Christian or more or less Christian writers who met in Oxford from about, well, depends on the dates, certainly 1930s through the 1950s. There's some fuzziness on either end of those dates. And these were the four main Inklings, so to speak, were C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Owen Barfield, and Charles Williams. Now, there were other people. This was a literary group. They would meet weekly in C.S. Lewis's rooms in Magdalen College. They would read their works in progress. There were various other people who would come. For instance, Warren Lewis, C.S. Lewis's brother, Christopher Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien's son, and Hugo Dyson, a variety of other people came and participated. But of those people, the four who have become the most significant writers were Barfield, Williams, Lewis, and Tolkien, and really Lewis and Tolkien head and shoulders above the rest in terms of the quality of their writing and the significance of it and its impact.
It's really interesting. I think when you were on Unbelievable, you said that Tolkien, for instance, did not like the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah, it's interesting because, no, he didn't. And now he read, and it's, I think, not even accurate to say the Chronicles of Narnia. He read most or perhaps all of the manuscript of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And he said, and this is his phrase, that it was outside of the range of his imaginative sympathy. It simply wasn't the kind of thing that he enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And so he never read the rest of them. He didn't like the mixing of genres that he perceived that Lewis was doing. But I think it's important to recognize Tolkien was an Anglo-Saxon specialist. He was a medievalist through and through. Now, Lewis was also a medievalist, but a medievalist and Renaissance scholar, although Lewis would have argued that that's a false division, and I think he's right. But Tolkien was very much an old English scholar. And he had very, very narrow tastes for his personal reading, just for his personal tastes. He liked almost nothing that was modern. So I think that when he said that he didn't care for Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I don't think we should really put a lot of weight on that in terms of his critical judgment. It just wasn't to his taste, and he honestly admitted that.
Peter Christ gave a talk one time where he's talking about the Lord of the Rings, and he said that there was a publishing house that wanted to find out what the greatest book of the past 100 years was. And the conclusion came back from voters, Lord of the Rings. But they didn't really like that. So they decided, we're going to have three other different accounts of books. They went, okay, the best novel worldwide, the best the past 1,000 years, and then we're going to do something on the Internet. And all the results they had came back every time, The Lord of the Rings. That it was the best novel of all. And, of course, it's been turned to a popular film lately. With Tolkien, it's interesting. He would not like it if we talked about his work as an allegory of a Christian faith, would he?
Yeah, because it would be inaccurate. It's not. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think that points to part of why it's so tremendously successful. And I actually, I would agree. I think the popular taste here is on to something. I would argue, and have argued for many years, even before I was a Christian, I argued this, that The Lord of the Rings is the most significant work of fiction of the 20th century, for sure. And I think actually calling it a novel is slightly problematic, in fact, and that's part of what makes it interesting, because novels, Tolkien's book actually changed our understanding of what a novel is, because when it came out, up until that time, novels primarily meant realistic fiction, and Tolkien's book is, it's fantasy, so he actually, when it first came out, people didn't know what it was, and if you read it thinking that it's going to be a realistic novel, you don't know what to make of it. Yet it also is not quite an old, you know, an epic saga. It's a new thing. And actually a lot of my academic work has been on examining what this new thing was. But it's not an allegory. And actually it probably wouldn't hurt if I took a moment to give the technical literary definition of allegory for your listeners.
Okay.
An allegory is a very specific literary technique, and it involves two layers, two levels to a story, where you have a story level, a narrative, events A, B, C, D, E, with characters, you know, X, Y, and Z, and you have a didactic element, something you want to teach with points 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. And an allegory is something that has correspondence, A1, B2, C3, consistently throughout the entire work, so that you can read the work as a story, or you can, in effect, translate it to read it as the didactic work. If it doesn't have that consistency of correspondence, it's not an allegory. And it's important to note that, because allegories have fallen out of favor. Really, the last thoroughgoing allegory, I would say, was probably Spenser's Fairy Queen. There might be other ones. But by the time you get to the 1600s, at any rate, allegory starts to be fading from view literarily. And I think, again, it has to do with the Enlightenment split. Because in medieval times, medieval writers loved allegory. And so, for instance, C.S. Lewis's first academic book was called The Allegory of Love, and it is specifically about medieval allegorical poetry. Great book. And medievals loved allegory because they didn't see a sharp separation between image and meaning. They were able to enjoy the book on both levels simultaneously. We've lost the ability to do that. So now when we read allegory, we're either reading it for one level, reading it for the other level, or doing a constant flip-flopping. People don't do that well anymore, and that's one of the reasons why modern Christian writers who attempt to write allegory usually catastrophically fail, because they don't know how to do it, and the audience doesn't know how to read it. So if you look at Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, or for that matter, C.S. Lewis' Chronicles of Narnia, which are also not allegorical, what you see are certain correspondences or relations. So, for example, in the Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan is very clearly a Christ figure. That's really the central, what Lewis himself said, that the Chronicles of Narnia are all about Christ, and he explores that really through a variety of non-allegorical ways. And I would recommend, actually, if readers want to know more about the way that Lewis was communicating about Christ in the Chronicles of Narnia, you just absolutely need to read my colleague Michael Ward's book, Planet Narnia, The Seven Heavens and the Imagination of C.S. Lewis. It just absolutely a must read. Or he has also a sort of a layman's version called The Narnia Code. So it's not allegory, but he's working with the image of, so Aslan is a Christ figure, and all of the books are, all seven of them, are exploring what it means to know Christ and what Christ is like through the imagery of medieval seven heavens. And it's not allegory. And what you get, for instance, in Lord of the Rings, is you get various Christ figures. So, for example, Frodo, as the ring bearer, is very much a Christ figure because he's bearing the burden of the ring to ultimately what he thinks is his death. But you can't make it into an allegory because it's far too rich and complex and multi-layered for that. And there's other Christ figures. Gandalf is a Christ figure who actually dies and is resurrected. And Aragorn is a Christ figure. He's a figure of Christ the King. And
yeah.
So you have all of these reflections or images of Christ, and you have throughout, and there's many, many other Christian images and ideas, but they're deeply infused, and it's not a one-to-one correspondence at all.
You know, it's interesting whenever I hear talk about Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia. I've spent a lot of time growing up in the role-playing industry and genre, and still enjoy that to this day. And when you were talking about how Tolkien came out with something totally new, I was sitting there thinking, and from what I gather, the role-playing industry today wouldn't really exist without its debt to writers like Tolkien, who made fantasy something totally new to be appreciated like that.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. Tolkien is, the Lord of the Rings ended up being kind of like a, you know, the black hole with this gravitational pull that warps everything after it. Everything after Tolkien has to respond to Tolkien. I think finally we're seeing some shifts in fantasy. It's been long enough. But what you get immediately after the Lord of the Rings is copying of it. The whole role-playing endeavor, it also is drawing on, and I was also into Dungeons & Dragons when I was younger. It also draws on older, you know, legends and epics, sort of, but yet primarily poaching off of Tolkien, because that's that sense of the epic quest. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that just, it's painful, because people have copied Tolkien, but they've copied, in a sense, the least significant part of it. Okay, it involves a quest, yes, but it's in order to understand the Lord of the Rings, it's all woven together, and this quest is radically different because, among other things, I mean, the quest image is ancient, but Tolkien's quest is unique because it's a quest to get rid of something, not to find it, which is the reverse of most of all of the other quests I can think of in previous literature. It's not a quest to find something, but to lose it. And you have the weakest person who's the one who in the end is given the task of finishing the quest. It goes against expectations in a variety of very interesting ways. And yeah, you get copied and copied and copied. And like any image, you photocopy, and in the end you get this blurry blah thing, and you think, who would want to read that? Go back and read the real thing.
You know, something we should also discuss, that a lot of Christians might be a bit antsy about reading books like these because they contain magic in them.
Yeah, and that's another really great question, or great topic, because I think we need to think about what do we mean by magic. And I think this takes us back also to how do we approach literature. Because on the one hand, speaking as a Christian, I want to affirm, I do believe that there are occult forces, there are demonic forces that are real, and we should not mess with them. We should not we should not use tarot cards or Ouija boards. We should not attempt to conjure. This is evil. It's playing with forces that are out to get us, and there's a reason why we're told not to do that. So I want to emphasize that when I talk about magic in fantasy, I am by no means saying that I don't believe that actual occult involvement is somehow not real. No, I'm quite clear on that. What I want to say, though, is that in literature, magic is, how should I put this? It's an image. It's almost, I want to say symbol, but that's a little bit too simplistic. It's a way of showing certain truths about the way that the world works. So, for instance, and in some cases, actually, it's just, like if we take, for instance, I'm going to step aside and say, let's look at Harry Potter. Some people have been very upset because the characters in Harry Potter, you know, they have spells and they cast spells and things like that. And I actually want to say that in this case, magic there is nothing but a term for almost a kind of technology, because there are certain forces like physics that if you learn the right ways of handling it, you get certain results. This is no different from learning how to use equations and math to get certain results to make, you know, an airplane fly. The actual terms, the actual words that she uses are just, frankly, there's Latin terms. They're just Latin made to sound magic-y. So if you actually say from like Expelliarmus, you're not actually saying a magic spell. You're saying Latin for throw it down. There's no possible harm that can come. This is not actually an occult word.
Yeah.
And it's actually interesting because Rowling in the books themselves actually is very, very clear to draw a distinction between that kind of magic and what she calls in the books the dark arts, which are involve evil spirits and harming people. And she's actually quite clear. This is wrong, and none of the good characters ever do it. So even within the world of Harry Potter, she's drawing a kind of a useful distinction. But if we look at something like The Lord of the Rings or The Chronicles of Narnia, what's actually, I think, much more interesting is that there isn't magic of that kind. It's more of a sense of creation. Like Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings doesn't do spells hardly at all. A few times he is able to create fire at one point. He's able to puts a spell of holding on a door, but it's always a sense that he's tapping into some deeper understanding of the way the world works. He's able to do these things. His role as a wizard actually doesn't have much to do with the quote-unquote magic that he does. It has to do with him as he's really an angelic figure. That's what Tolkien clarifies later on in some of the writings. He has great wisdom. He has great authority. He has great foresight. He has great discernment. These characteristics are actually what make him the figure that he is in The Lord of the Rings, not like spells. And even when we have the elves in Lord of the Rings, it's very clear that they're depicted as beings, created beings of a somewhat different order. And what we would call magic, they don't see as magic. They just are able to draw on natural forces to create, for instance, rope that is particularly sort of blessed or beneficial to the user. And that's not even remotely the same kind of thing that we're talking about when it comes to magic, in the Chronicles of Narnia, there's really almost no magic per se. There's a little bit of it. There's a book of spells in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, but those are depicted again as these are, you know, things that can cause certain effects if you know how to use them, and they can be used well or they can be used badly. And in fact, Aslan rebukes Lucy for using one of them when she shouldn't have. So it's a sense of, in the fantasy world, magic is almost an image of any human use of power, any human use of will or of technology. And I think that helps us to think about how do we use technology. Like, honestly, like my smartphone, the fact that I can call up a map on it and it can tell me where I am and where my destination is, how is that not magic?
Because
it's technology. Yeah, I mean, it's me, you know, making some finger motions on an object and, you know, here I am, I know where I am and where I need to go. This is really a form of the human use of technology to do things. And in a story form, I think something like the use of magic, like the magic spells that we see in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, or other aspects of magic in story,
I think the fact that it's presented in the form of magic spells distances us enough that it helps us think about it more clearly. Because seeing, for instance, Lucy in The Voyage of the Bounty Treader being tempted to cast a spell to make herself beautiful, that allows us, and Aslan appearing to her and warning her off, and then her using, kind of rebelliously, using another spell to listen in to what one of her classmates is saying about her. And then she ends up being really hurt because she hears her classmate saying some unkind things. And Aslan then says to her, well, you know, you shouldn't have listened. And that kind of use of magic in a story does what all good stories should do. It helps us see our own situation more clearly. It's what Tolkien calls in his great essay on fairy stories, recovery. Because after we read about Lucy and the Magician's Book, and we come back to the modern world, and, you know, I might go and be tempted to post a status on Facebook that's bragging about something I'm doing. How different is that from Lucy using the spell to make herself beautiful? Well, maybe I should step back and say, am I using technology to manipulate others' view of me? Maybe I shouldn't do that. And so I think the use of magic as a story element is so different, so fundamentally different from magic as a cult, actual practice, that the two things are apples and oranges. They're not even fruit. They're like apples and, you know, something else.
Well, we're going to take our final break here and give some comments on what Dr. Wardrey just said when we come back. My name is Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back to wrap things up after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com. Home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
I'd like to give a bit of a heads up on some topics that Dr. Ordway talked about. When she talked about Via Cart, we are scheduled to have on October 12th Jeff Harshberger come on our program to talk about how he came out of Satanism. And since she brought up Harry Potter on November 16th, I'm hoping that we will have Hogwarts professor John Granger on here about finding God in Harry Potter. But now we're going to wrap. Are you familiar with finding God in Harry Potter? It sounds like you had some reaction there, Dr. Woodway.
So have I read it, you said?
Yeah, it sounds like you were thinking something when I said that.
I think, well, I mean, actually I quite like the Harry Potter books. I think they're slightly overrated, but they're good stories. And I think actually that I think J.K. Rowling has a basically Christian worldview that she's expressing in them. I think that one of the things I think is underrated in the Harry Potter books is their portrayal of marriage and family, because I think you'll be hard pressed to find other young adult books that are popular that portray such a good depiction of marriage. I mean, the Weasleys, for instance, that family it's a big family. They're poor, but they love each other, and the marriage of you know, Mr. and Mrs. Weasley and their care for their children is unambiguously depicted as positive throughout the entire series. And you see many other instances of that. And in fact, the ending of the series affirms the goodness of marriage and of having children. And honestly, it's worth the price of admission for that alone, I think, in our current culture.
Yeah, I actually quite enjoy the Harry Potter books. I've read all of them. I've seen all the movies. So I own all the movies, in fact. And when I was reading them, I was actually reading them in audio. And the guy who does the audio does such a great job. And I'd pull up somewhere and say, okay, I'm gonna stop the tape after this. it was just a very hard work to stop, and John Granger's work I found to be incredibly interesting on it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, they're good stories. They're fun stories.
Yeah.
They're well told. And I think they're lots of fun.
Yeah, I think that's the contrast with something that you've talked about here, that too many of our Christian stories, we haven't used a word, but too many of our Christian works are ever cheesy today. They're so explicit, they're in your face. Like, for instance, the Left Behind novels. I've got a problem with the dispensationalist viewpoint of eschatology anyway, but just reading the novels as novels, I read those audio as well for a while, and I got to the end of one of them, and I never really went back to the library to get the next one. There were other things that were coming up, and I'm not just sitting on the edge of my seat thinking, oh, geez, I wonder what happens next. It's just I could not engage with the character that much, really.
Yeah, and I get this a lot with, for instance, if I critique something like the Left Behind novels or insipid Christian romances where the worst difficulty that anybody has is, you know, a little bit of, you know, mild sadness. Oh, I'm not sure if he likes me. If I critique that, I'll inevitably get something like, but the author's really a faithful Christian, or but the moral is really good, or but at least it's presenting a wholesome worldview. And I'm thinking, we really are so selling ourselves short, because why we should not have to say, yeah, this is cheesy and it's not a very good story, but no. Just stop right there. Because if you think about it, Christians should aspire to have their books shelved with all of the non-Christian books. So, for example, Jane Austen was a devout Christian. I mean, she's completely devout Christian, and it's apparent in her letters, it's apparent actually in her books. But her books are not, you know, pushing a Christian moral in your face. They're really, really good books that are grounded in her faith, and she has a variety of characters. Some of them are better than others, and they're really well-drawn characters in situations that we really empathize with and we care about them. And they're shelved in the fiction section, and millions of people love these novels. Or, for example, C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, to talk about some of his other fiction, because we talked about the Chronicles of Narnia quite a bit. His Space Trilogy is fantastic. The Ransom Trilogy is the better title for it. These are really excellent books. They're deeply Christian. In fact, that Hideous Strength really works out a lot of the ideas that Lewis articulated in his nonfiction book, The Abolition of Man. But where do we find the Ransom Trilogy? We find it shelved in the science fiction section, not in the Christian fiction section. Because he doesn't have conversations where you have, so, Bob, do you know Jesus? Why, Joe, I don't. Tell me about Jesus. Oh, kill me now!
C.S. Lewis, he talked about this with Watch for Dragons, didn't he?
Yes. And now, that's a quote that he's talking there about how, as a child, he had in Sunday school, he was raised as a Christian, and he lost his faith, actually, as a young teenager. And then he became an atheist, and he came back to his faith. So he actually is able to give quite a lot of insight into what causes someone to lose their faith, as well as the experience of being an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a kind of Sunday school experience where, in church and in sermons, where he was always told what he should feel. You should love Jesus. You should feel this. You should feel that. And when you're told what you should feel, it really has a tendency to leave you cold. And then you end up with your guard up, and you end up rejecting anything that has those Sunday school associations. So for Lewis, when he's writing here about the Chronicles of Narnia, he's talking about the way in which using a fantasy world enables him to deal with themes and ideas, primarily with who's Christ. And what is it like to know Christ? That's the fundamental core, the Christological core of the Narnia books.
he's getting past the watchful dragons of that knee-jerk reaction against kind of Christian sentimentality by counting it in this fresh new light. But I think the idea of watchful dragons has kind of a, it's a great phrase, because I think we can have different kinds of watchful dragons where we might have different reactions against Christianese. Like, I never had that. I didn't have the upbringing. I didn't go to church as a kid. So I didn't have the Christian sentimentality sort of shoved down my throat as a little kid. But what I did experience as an adult was the pushy adult in your face, here's a Bible, you know, get with the program kind of thing, without any context, without any sense of what does this even mean or relationship. And so those were kind of my watchful dragons. And I think that doing good stories and doing good poetry will get past the watchful dragons of people who just resent. Well, people don't like being preached at. And preached at is the word here. Because if I mean, when I go to church now, I hear the homily and I take it in because I'm edified, and I take it as teaching because I've come to worship, and this is part of that experience. Word, you know, we've got word and we've got Eucharist and we've got the whole thing. I'm here for that whole experience of worship. That's very different from someone getting preached at. Let me tell you how you ought to believe. Well, no. So
it's
story by being
very interesting. Now we said that even the term preaching today has a negative connotation to it.
Yeah. It does, and that's a shift. So now we have to think, what was it that Christians have done that has helped this shift to happen? Because in a certain sense, I think we have to recognize that some of it is simply the rebellious heart that doesn't want to deal with confronting the claims of Christ. That's an element. But I think Christian apologists tend to take that easy out a little bit too quickly and to say, oh, they're rejecting our evangelism because they're hard-hearted. Well, it could be partly that, but it could be that they're rejecting our evangelism because we're doing a lousy job. We're being jerks. Or we're speaking a Christianese language that doesn't have meaning.
Right. Now, we're getting ready to wrap things up. We've got about 7 minutes in the show left. Let's get some things up. If my audience wants to know more about you, Holly, where can they find you?
Well, I would direct them, especially for my academic work, to come to HBU's page. So if you go to hbu.edu/MAA, then you'll actually find the Master of Arts in Apologetics program has my faculty profile and has a link actually from there to my blog, Chiropraxis, where I write on culture and literature in general. And actually, if you follow that link, the hbu.edu/MAA, that will actually get you to know several of the other people that I've mentioned. For instance, my colleague, Michael Ward, and his work, which is also, I mean, he is another major figure in literary apologetics. And so anybody who's been interested in what we've been talking about should look at Dr. Ward's work as well, because he's also doing this work.
We are hoping that sometime we can get him on this show as well. We talked about one time we were hoping to have him on this month, but things didn't work out, so I'm hoping I'll be able to get in touch with him again, have him come on and discuss it, being on the show.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. But in the meantime, at least he's got some great books.
You also talk about Chiropraxis. What is that?
That's actually a blog. It's my blog. It's a multi-author blog. I've got about six other folks who write for me. And Chiropraxis, HIEROPRAXIS. I did the Humpty Dumpty move, and I made up a word. Hiero means holy, praxis means practice in Greek, and I just made it up because I wanted to have a site that explored the practice of living out the Christian faith. And it's a place where I do a lot of writing on culture and literature. My other writers do various apologetics themes, writing on what it means to be a writer.
So it's a very interesting, fairly diverse group. It's a bigger Christian group. All of us are Christian, but we come from various traditions and a lot of sort of different perspectives, but all kind of oriented around a kind of imaginative engagement and a cultural engagement.
Okay, so we've got a little under 5 minutes left. What kind of message would you like to leave my listening audience? What's the main thing that you think they should get out of what you've been saying?
I would say that we need to recognize the role of the imagination as a legitimate aspect of how we engage with the world, and imagination as a really important mode of knowledge and of communicating.
Yeah.
And because of the importance of the imagination, we need to recover a sense of the importance of literature. Christians need to read more, and I would challenge Christians to really pursue excellence in writing and not view writing as a utilitarian endeavor, but use it as an expression of, I mean, we have our God, he's a creative God. He made the heavens and the earth and all that is in it, and we're made in his image. So the expression of creativity is part of expressing the image of God in us. And I would also encourage people who are intrigued by this to think, I really want to learn more. I want to do this. I want to engage in imaginative apologetics. I would invite them to think about studying with me and with Dr. Ward at HBU, because I hope they're, I mean, this is my focus, is in literary and imaginative apologetics, and so is Dr. Ward's. And I would love for folks who are serious about this to come join our program, study with me, and we will do great things.
Yeah, I know Mike Lacona told me so much about all the good things that you have going on at HBU, and we are working on getting some other guests on there. For instance, I can tell listeners that in a couple of months, we're going to have someone who's either getting ready to join the faculty or has already joined. That's going to be Lee Strobar from HBU is going to be on here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm overwhelmed by how awesome my colleagues are. It's like, really? Pinch me. Am I dreaming? No, I'm not. We're really doing this.
Yeah, it's so incredible. I mean, he talked about how N.T. Wright was coming to HBU recently, part of like a quick speaking engagement, such not join our faculty, but just coming something else. I said, you know, you've never taken me to HBU before.
Yeah, we're doing cool things. It's an exciting moment for the kingdom. We're doing big things, I think.
Yeah, and one of the great benefits of being there is that you've got several Christians, students there who aren't Christians, in fact. And yet they go in and they get a Christian education.
The undergraduate population is about 30% non-Christian. So it really is a phenomenal. And for our apologetics graduate students who are all Christian, what a great environment for them to actually see a genuine diversity of folks and interact with folks. And actually, I should add, this is breaking news. We have just gotten full approval. Our apologetics master's degree is now approved for 100% online. And so we actually started it part-time online this fall. We also... If students apply this semester, they can join us in the spring. But in fall of 2014, we will be full-time. The entire program will be online. So students can complete the entire master's degree completely from a distance, no residency requirement, through our online program. And that has just been officially approved.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Ordway, I really want to thank you for being my guest today. This has been an excellent show, very informative.
Thank you so much for having me on, Nick. This was great fun.
I hope we'll see you again.
I hope so. All right.
And
bye-bye.
I'd like to remind everyone that next week, John Stewart of Ratio Christi will be our guest, and I'll see you then. But for now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off, hoping to see you next time.